Hi, guys. We want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you are listening to Maltin on Movies. And we are really happy today to have somebody we admire a whole lot, namely Brad Bird.
Brad Bird!
Hello.
Yes.
Was that hello?
That was, yes. Okay. That is hello and Brad
Very
Bird.
Very good.
You know, the
They don't know which one of us did it.
No.
Yeah.
Well,
now they do.
Now they do. But they didn't know before.
This is the Brad Bird who's made Oscar-winning movies like The Incredibles and Ratatouille and a whole lot of other stuff, because we're going to talk about that other stuff for the rest of this program. We just love what you do, Brad.
Thank you very much.
And you have such an interesting story.
Uh-oh.
You are. No, you are.
You're That's code for... It's going to come back to bite me or something.
No. Yeah. But talk about the old men. Start from the beginning.
The nine old men.
So much.
Yeah. Well, I got to meet eight of them.
And we should just preface this by saying, because everybody in animation knows who we're talking about, mm-hmm. but some people might not.
Right. Disney's nine old men who were the master animators at Disney during Walt's lifetime.
Yep.
Amazing. Lead talented people. I didn't get to meet John. No, I did get to meet. I did not get to meet John Lounsbery. He signed a Christmas card that to me that I got from the studio, mm-hmm. But I never got to meet him. But I met everyone else.
And these are legends.
Yeah.
We don't throw that word around lightly. No. These really are legends. No.
Well, what's funny to remember is that when I was starting in animation and we were at CalArts, a lot of people who have made films now, like Henry Selick and John Musker and Jerry Reese and, a whole bunch of guys. At that time, because we just had the Annies the other night, and I was thinking back to when I was a student, the Annies were at the Sportsman's Lodge. and literally every great animator that you can think of was still alive and kicking then. You know, Tex Avery was doing commercials at the time.
Wow.
And so we were, starry-eyed over these people who were basically ignored the other 99.9999 part of their life. And we knew who they were, and they were legendary to us, but it was before a lot of them, some of them were just beginning to be celebrated. Mm-hmm. But they never really got the adoration that they deserved.
These are the people who invented animation.
Yeah, right.
Who made all those cartoons that my generation grew up watching daily on television.
Right, absolutely.
And that an earlier generation saw on movie screens, in theaters.
Right. Well, they had the art form had attracted a lot of talent in the 30s, and then it never grew beyond that in terms of its size or output. So that group of people that came into it in the 30s, they took up the bulk of the employment for the next 30 or 40 years, which meant that no one young was coming in and learning their secrets. Mm-hmm. And suddenly late Disney films like Jungle Book were succeeding, and they looked around and realized nobody was being trained to pick up this ball. Mm-hmm. So full animation, where the characters move a lot and you spend some time on it, was basically right at death's door when we were showing up. And, Disney was the only place on earth that was making full animation, and they were making one film every 3 years. So back in those Sportsman's Lodge days, if you made an animated film, you got nominated for because that there wasn't enough.
There weren't options.
Sure.
There were no options. Yeah. So things have changed hugely since then.
And you were how old when you made your first pilgrimage to Disney Studio?
I was 11. Yeah.
And what did you do? Did you just show up at the front gate?
No.
We're here to see the wizard.
Yeah. I was something, you know, I knew about animation and I sort of knew that there were a bunch of drawings that gave the appearance of movement. But when I saw Jungle Book, something snapped in me and I realized that it was somebody's job to figure out how a stuffy panther moved. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't any kind of animal, it was a cat. And it wasn't any kind of cat, it was a panther. And it wasn't any kind of panther, it was a stuffy panther. So it was so specific, you know what I mean? A cat does not move like a dog. There's a silkiness and there's no abrupt movement in a cat unless it's frightened or something. Whereas dogs have a lot of abrupt movement. And then panthers have a different quality of movement from tigers or house cats or mountain lions. They all have their own quirks. And it was clear looking at it, even at 11, something snapped in me that somebody figured out this stuff and that was a job. It was somebody's job to figure out how a stuffy panther would move. Suddenly, you know, it's like one of those things where you're a kid, you enjoy being a kid. You're kind of dreading growing up because it seems like they're kind of slow moving and dull, you know, and then you start to realize that there are all these really cool jobs out there. And suddenly it seems exciting to grow up. It doesn't seem like it's a drag. It's not Peter Pan, you know, I'm never going to grow up. It's like, how soon can I grow up and do one of these weird jobs, you know?
Were you a kid who always drew?
I did. The only thing that was weird is the first drawings that I did I was about age 3, and they were absolutely, there was nothing remotely exceptional about the drawings. They were dots for eyes, line for a smile, you know, scribbles for hands, you know, one line for the arms. But there was one thing that was weird about them, and that's that the very first drawings I did were sequential. They were meant to be seen in an order, and I would just explain the story while I showed the drawings. And like I said, the drawings were not exceptional. They were absolutely a normal 3-year-old level of drawing. Mm-hmm. But what was weird is they were meant to be viewed in a certain order. And I would try to tell the story as I was showing the pictures. And I think in my own weird way, from the very beginning, I was trying to make movies.
Wow.
Yeah. So you were asking, how did I get to Disney?
Yeah.
So something snapped in me. We happened to be with somebody that night who had taken an animation class. And I said, how do you do that? And they went, well, you know, each drawing is slightly different and da-da-da. I said, I know that. I said, how do I do it? And they said, and we happened to be a fluke with someone who took animation in college. And they said, you have to get a camera stand so the camera doesn't move. The camera has to be able to shoot one frame at a time. And my parents basically got those things together to make that happen. At the same time, friends of my parents went to Oregon State University in Corvallis, where I grew up, with George Bruns, who did the music for all the films. So they said, George is coming up. Would you like to meet him? And I'm like, would I? You know? So he came up, and we were at the beach. And he was very tolerant while I just carpet bombed him with questions, you know. Do you know, because my parents got me a book about Disney animation, The Art of Animation by Bob Thomas.
Yes, great book.
And great book. And I had worn it out reading it so many times. Mm-hmm. And so I asked all these questions about how he did his job. You know, does he know this guy? Does he know that person? And what about Mary Blair? And you know, it's like just blah, 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 blah. And he said, are you ever down in L.A.? And he said, next time you're down in L.A., you know, I'll take you through the studio and you can meet everybody. So, you know, instantly my head snaps in the direction of my parents, like, how soon can you get me to LA, you know? And he took me through the studio, and I met everybody, and I every department, and he took me through in order of the process.
Oh, wow.
You know, so he started me with story, and I met Ken Anderson, who was doing all this artwork for Aristocats and stuff like that. And I met the animators, and I remember meeting Frank and Ollie the first time. And
that's
they,
Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just
got to
the,
explain this.
For the,
I think of you as an animation guy, so I feel like I can short stroke all this
thank
stuff.
You. But no, well, it's
short
a compliment.
Short stroke.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I met Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, who did another amazing book, and were two of the nine old men. And I remember George saying, this is Brad. He started his first animated film, and he's going to be an animator someday. And they kind of looked at me, and I can't forget the expression, but this very patient kind of smile that basically said, in 2 weeks, you're going to lose interest, kid, and we're never going to see you again. Right? Just like, okay, we've heard this before. Yes, it'll be novel for a couple of weeks, and then you'll be bored because it's you have to sit in a spot and be patient for mm-hmm. a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were shocked when I showed up 3 years later with a 15-minute film.
Wow.
And then they basically, my parents had told me, always start at the top. And they said, whoever you admire most, go to them first. Then when you get a no from them, who you admire the second most.
Mm-hmm.
And down the list, and then the first person that agrees to talk to you will be the best person you can get. And so I thought, who's at the top? It's Disney, you know? So I sent this film to Disney, and they responded.
Was Walt still alive?
No. Sad to say, he was not. But I sent it to Disney Studio.
Yeah, got
it.
Yeah.
And
care of Mickey Mouse.
Yes. Well, actually, it was the guy who was kind of interfacing was named Donald Duckwall, believe it or not.
That's right.
His real name was Donald Duckwall. Yeah. But anyway, they kind of flung their doors open, and I was assigned Milt Kahl as a mentor. And so, you know, and for me, that was like being into acting and being assigned to Brando.
Yeah.
And but I couldn't talk about it with any of my friends because nobody knew who Milt Kahl was.
Summarize, if you can, Milt Kahl.
Well, for me, he and Frank Thomas are the two best animators that have ever lived.
Mm.
They had different strengths and weaknesses, but they were both on that ridiculous level where you can't even really discuss it. You just say they're great. You know, there's a level where you rank people, and then there's a certain point when they get to be a certain level of talent where they're just above the clouds and you just give up and just say they're great. It's like, do you argue about the Beatles versus Mozart? No, you just go, nah, they're both just great.
Yeah, yeah.
They're both just great, you know?
Some of Milt Kahl's greatest hits.
You're right.
Well, just in Jungle Book, he did every character, but he alone did Shere Khan.
Mm-hmm.
He designed Pinocchio. You know, you can't, talking about,
God.
Well, I just mean there's so much.
No, it is.
And it's all just phenomenal level stuff. His last thing, not a very great movie, but, he did, Madame Medusa in The Rescuers. And if you just mm-hmm. look at
oh,
Madame
I love
Medusa,
her.
It's beautiful animation, and it's crazy, and it's
just
really well done.
Just taking her eyelashes off.
Oh, that's yes.
Which he got from a former wife. and he watched her as, you know, animators are observers, and he watched her take off these eyelashes.
Oh, my God.
And he specifically asked them to do painting so that the skin was kind of raw
yes.
where she pulls off the eyelashes. I mean, it was his idea to like ask for a very special ink and paint job on her
wow.
skin around her eyes. So, you know, I think he was enacting a little bit of revenge on a former wife.
That's great.
Yeah.
So he became your mentor.
Right? It was before they had a training program in place. Mm-hmm. So they just thought, we'll give you to our best guy. Mm-hmm. And they didn't realize that temperament-wise, he would probably frighten away 99 out of 100 people.
Yes.
Because he sputtered a lot. He was incredibly passionate and demanding about animation. And I remember him calling animators who didn't do the same amount of preparation that he did. He called them lazy bastards, mm-hmm. you know. And that means that unless you work your ass off, you are a lazy bastard. Mm-hmm. Wow. And that's what I got indoctrinated with. In a weird coincidence, my character was fine with his character. He didn't frighten me, you know. He was intimidating a little bit, but I was so in awe of his talent that you know, I remember taking in a scene. He would give me these little test scenes to do, and I took in a scene, and he laughed at it, which is, you only got that first impression once, and then he kind of reset his body, and he kind of flipped, like, okay, now I'm going to let you have it, you know? And he would say, you know, you didn't even explore the possibilities here, you know? What kind of a person is this? What are they thinking? You know, you know, and he would go through this thing. And I was calling my mom because I had a, you know, I would stay down for a week and stay with my parents' friends, and I would actually go in like going to work, right? Mm-hmm. And I said to my mom one night, I said, oh man, I have so much to learn to even just be able to, you know. And, you know, I told him that I did a gag. He wanted to have Goofy grabbing a bag full of weights. Now, why there was a bag full of weights is never explained. He just wanted to see somebody who's preparing to do one thing and then suddenly being surprised and having another. So I had his arm dislocate and kind of unroll like a fire hose from his shoulder. And Milt laughed because I had Goofy then pick up his arm and let it drop, you know, like what happened to my arm. And he laughed, but he said, we don't do that here, you know. He said, that's more like a Fleischer, you know, thing, you know. And so I knew what he was talking about. It's Fleischer Studios who did Popeye and Betty Boop, but they had kind of rubber hose arm kind of animation. And I was telling my mother, you know, he said, we don't do that here. And she said, no, you're not getting it. He said, we. He's including you with them. And you know, see past the criticism. He's taking time out of his day to talk to you and analyze stuff, and he's open to it, and he's inviting you to bring more stuff in. She goes, don't feel bad, feel good.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, oh God, that's right.
That was so perceptive of her.
Yeah, that was great. Well, my mom was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it made a huge influence on me, and it sticks with me to this day. I think there's a sense in the movie business, whether it's animation or live action, of ageism, where you only hire people that are in their 20s and 30s because those people have the pulse of the, and I have the exact opposite point of view. I revere people who are really experienced and have seen a lot and tried a lot, so I hire them. And sometimes I'm surprised that they're available because don't you know what this person did?
Yeah.
They did this, 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 and this, and they're still sharp, you know, why, you know? And I think that comes courtesy of working with those guys when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. because they were at the absolute height of their powers, and they were still not satisfied with their work, mm-hmm. which made a big impression on me.
Yeah.
Now you, which is funny, just a little tangent, but your collaborator, the brilliant composer Michael Giacchino, feels the same way about musicians.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
And he hires the oldest musicians mm-hmm. in town.
We had Jack Hayes, who is one of the oldest arrangers. He's mm-hmm. no longer with us, mm-hmm. but he had worked on stuff in the 50s and all this stuff. He arranged several numbers in Incredibles.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And Michael gave him the cues to mm-hmm. say, let's see what you do. And he kind of cast it because he knew what Jack Hayes mm-hmm. did. And there is, yeah, I absolutely share that with Jacquino. We mm-hmm. have absolute reverence for the masters and, you know, be they male, female, whatever.
Yeah.
If they've worked on a great body of work, we can't wait to work with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you work with Ward Kimball at all?
I did. I took drawing classes from Ward Kimball.
Oh, wow.
At Disney. And it was on the stage that you record on. So we, you know, I regularly record on that stage, stage B. You know it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, you've shot the video stuff yep. right in front yep. of it. But anyway, that's a legendary recording studio because all of these great films, you know, Peggy Lee sung He's a Tramp in there. Louis Prima did mm-hmm. I Want to Be Like You in this room. All this stuff has been recorded in this room, but they taught a drawing class back in there hmm. when I was an animator there. And Ward Kimball taught the class.
Wow. I loved Ward mostly because he looked like an animated character.
Yes.
He looked like some sort yeah. of cartoon. And as a kid, that was like the most entertaining thing in the world.
Yeah, and he was always one to pour a little, you know, vinegar on
yes.
Any adulation for Disney, you know. He would say to us, you know, Walt's dead and you missed it, you know? And, you know, and we'd go, oh, you know, oh, that hurts, you know? But what he was trying to say is just seize the moment that you
yes,
have.
Yes, right.
Don't just stare at our stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
And I thought that was a great thing for him to say.
Now, CalArts, when did that enter the picture for you?
Well, they were starting the animation program when I got out of high school, and mm-hmm. it was the first year of the program for character animation. They mm-hmm. had an animation program with Jules Engels
mm-hmm.
That was all kinds of animation, experimental, all different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
But no one at that time was being taught character animation, which is acting, really, in animation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's a certain skill. And the market, I hate talking about it that way, but the market for character animation was tiny then because 99% of the stuff being done was really limited animation done for television.
Mm-hmm.
And what people didn't realize is that most of the good early animation done for television were done by people who were trained in full animation. Mm-hmm. So you see the Flintstones, part of the reason they're visually appealing is the people that are doing it did the Tom and Jerry cartoons, which are some of the best cartoons ever made.
Mm-hmm.
The Hanna-Barbera ones.
Right.
To be clear, I'm not talking about even Chuck Jones did not great versions of Tom and Jerry, and he admitted it.
Yeah.
You know, he was perfect for Bugs and the Warners, but maybe not Tom and Jerry. In fact, Tom and Jerry are the most screwed up characters that have ever happened. They've been abused more times in the last, you know what I mean?
Yes.
The
oh,
last great Tom and Jerry cartoon was like in the late 50s, and they've been abused over and over by a score of people. They've been made friends, you know, which is just an absolutely, you know, head slapping.
Jerry wears a bow tie. We won't go into
oh,
all
no,
that.
Oh,
yeah. There's so many. It's so wrong for so much
no.
of its time on Earth. But anyway.
No.
And they've talked.
Yes.
They've talked. I mean, they've screwed that concept up. They're the most abused comic book character or comic characters there are. Yeah.
However.
We should start a support club.
Yes.
However.
Yeah. Really.
CalArts.
CalArts. So
they're getting together this new program.
They're starting the program, and that's where I met John Musker, who ended up doing Little Mermaid and Aladdin and recently Moana.
Mm-hmm. The Johns.
Yeah. And Tim Burton went there. Chris Buck was in year two with Tim Burton.
Who just co-directed Frozen.
Yeah. Frozen, yeah, and did Surf's Up and, mm-hmm. You know. So Jerry Reese, who did Brave Little Toaster, was mm-hmm. was there with us. Henry Selick, who did Nightmare Before Christmas, and recently Coraline. And so it was this very small but concentrated group. And I think part of the reason it had so many people in it is there was nowhere else to learn mm-hmm. this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So We all sort of found each other, and it was the first time in any of our lives that we had been able to talk about this stuff because none of our friends gave a crap about it.
And of course, this was long before the internet.
Yes.
Social media. Being
yeah.
able to.
We were young once. Yeah.
I feel I have to underscore that, though, because if you were the only kid in Corvallis, Oregon, who, you know, who cared about this.
I was probably the only kid in Oregon or, right. or the Pacific Northwest. Let's keep expanding the borders. But like John Hubley, who was one of my heroes, came to talk at Reed College when I was a kid. And my mom, you know, God bless her, I went, John Hubley's going to be at Reed College. And she's like, okay, let's go. And so she drove me all the way to Portland to see John Hubley talk about his films.
Great.
And I was the only kid in a class full of college people, you know. Mm-hmm. But I got to meet John Hubley, which was really cool.
Pretty neat. So can you describe for us the we were talking about this
before. Yeah, about what CalArts is
the
like.
The atmosphere. It's such a... at CalArts with all of these budding talents.
Well, it was strange. It's not what people think it was. A large part of the school had an attitude toward the animation program because we were the corporate sellouts. You know, Disney or CalArts was kind of founded by Disney.
Yeah. Right.
And this was the one program in the school that was traditionally... it was aiming at traditional classical drawing skills and aimed at being employed as a character animator. So some people, a significant amount, viewed it like a step above greeting cards, you know, being like an illustrator for Hallmark or something. And they had a snobby attitude toward it. Mm-hmm. Other people were fine. But what I'm saying is now animation is seen as a very cool occupation.
Right.
And everyone wants to do it, and it's admired. And there are many animation schools everywhere. And people are actively pursuing it as a job in record numbers.
Yeah.
That is completely the opposite. It was a candle that was almost out. Our first class was like 18 people in the class. Mm. And it was all in one, all of our classes, the entire schedule, every day, the whole week was in one windowless room. That's A113 that we ended up, I started this trend of putting that number in the films. And people think it's a Pixar thing. I actually started it on Family Dog. It was so tiny, and it was in a little hole in the basement. And then gradually now it is the entire... what used to be the design loft, which is three stories. And it's one of the things that CalArts is famous for is its animation program.
Sure.
But this was not then.
Yeah.
This was way before that. And we were a tiny little band, you know?
Mm-hmm. And tiny little band of artists, soul searchers.
Well, I mean,
hippies,
some,
what, how?
You know, animators tend to be quieter in general. I'm not one of those guys. And Milt wasn't either, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Tended to be the people that stood back at the dances and watched everybody and then could do a mean impression of what so-and-so did at that dance. But they were the people that stood back in the walls and watched. They're watchers. Right. Animation people in general, if you're going to generalize, are watchers. And they are watching on a level that most people don't watch, you know, because they can actually break it down and show specifically how someone moves versus how someone else moves.
Is that why so many animators do caricatures of each other, you think?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they're ruthless.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the drawing equivalent of one of those really nasty roasts.
That right.
Yeah.
That's
totally, great comparison.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect
comparison.
And they do it all the time.
That's so funny.
And, you know, like on Incredibles, I didn't know that Syndrome, the villain, was me, because you often don't see yourself.
Of course.
You're blind to yourself. Mm-hmm. So we're well into production. The character's designed, built. We're probably halfway through all the scenes. And suddenly I go, is that supposed to be me? And everybody starts laughing, and it's like, now he's noticing. And it's like, I'm like, you see me as the villain?
Oh my God.
It's like, my hair isn't like that, but other parts of my face are kind of like that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you assholes, you know? You know? And they were just like, ha, 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 you know? God. But it was too late to change at that point.
So that's it.
I'm the villain, that's, I guess.
One of my favorite things is watching when they show the sort of behind-the-scenes clips with an animator with a mirror, when they're sort of figuring out, making faces. Mm-hmm. And there's one that I always think of with Andreas Deja. Uh-huh. And because I think that Andreas looks like his characters, because definitely Jafar, definitely Scar, you can see it, his face, and I just, it's one of my favorite things when we watch the hand-drawn stuff.
Yeah, I love
that's
hand-drawn.
Definitely so-and-so, mm-hmm. because I can see that's their eyes, that's their nose. It's
that's true.
People know about some of the high points of your career. Iron Giant has become commercially successful movie at the time it
not.
Came out.
People are finally wising up.
Yes.
I think it's commercially successful now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, they keep making new discs of it and more products keep coming out featuring it. Yeah.
Because it's a damn good movie. Exactly. That's why.
Thank you.
and most people thought so then, too, who saw
it. Anyone who saw it tended to like it. Yeah.
So we know about that. We know about how you answered the call to go up to Pixar and all of that. But people may not know of your involvement with The Simpsons. Would you tell us how that came about?
Sure. I had done an animated segment. I'd worked on two episodes of Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories.
How did that come about?
Well, that is a roundabout story. I'm trying to think of the brief version of it. I tried to get Family Dog made as shorts. I tried to pitch Steven on the idea of doing theatrical shorts. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to sell distributors on the idea of it because nobody wanted to lengthen show times unless there was a commercial advantage to doing it. And so, you know, Steven loved the idea, but he didn't know of a way to coax people to not be, how do we get that so that it pays for itself?
Right.
And the project kind of laid dormant for a little bit. Then a friend of mine, Matthew Robbins, who is a screenwriter and co-wrote Sugarland Express, which was Spielberg's first theatrical film, got an episode of Amazing Stories offered to him. And it was right when things were, you know, collapsing for me. We had tried to make an animated feature of The Spirit, which is Will Eisner's comic. And it's very revered among the comic book community, but it's not widely known. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the anti-superhero thing. He doesn't have any powers or anything. And it's really fascinating. I mean, it's super well drawn. It's kind of like the Citizen Kane of comic books. But anyway, that had collapsed. And I was looking for something, and we were just having lunch, and he said, there's this new show that Steven's doing, and I think, you know, he's going to give me an episode. And I said, well, if you don't like the script, I'm here, right? And so he got it. He really liked the idea, but he had problems with the script. So he said, well, let's go back to Steven's initial idea, because it was Steven's idea. It wasn't a script, but it was his idea. Let's go back to his little half-page breakdown of what it is and do a whole new script. And so I did that. Steven really liked it. And I came down to do more Amazing Stories because he said, you should do more.
And that was an anthology show. So
yes,
each episode was a one-off.
Right, like kind of like Twilight Zone or something like that. And he said, I had brought another family dog that I had done in storyboard sort of thumbnails in the interim. And it had been probably 4 years since he'd seen it, or 5 years. And I showed him the new ones, and he laughed at it, and he said, "Can you do a half hour of this?" And I said, "For sure." And he said, "Let's do it as an episode of Amazing Stories." So of the 44 episodes, I think he had a 44-episode commitment, 2-year commitment. I worked on one live action one. I wrote it, and I'm even in it, and for a second as scientist number two. Very memorable. And I did the only animated episode of it. And that caught the attention of Sam Simon and Jim Brooks, because they were starting to make a TV series out of The Simpsons, which were short films on Tracy Ullman's show.
I remember that.
So they invited me to join the show right as it was becoming its own series. And I essentially stayed on the show as a consultant for the first 8 seasons. And it was like boot camp, because you had to produce these really kind of complicated scripts very quickly. And I learned so much on that show that I would not have been able to do Iron Giant if I hadn't done that show, because of the having to make decisions quickly and have them stick, you mm-hmm. know, and it was like boot camp for that.
By the way, just parenthetically, the first time I saw your name, became aware of you, I saw Family Dog in a movie theater.
Huh. Mm. There were 3 segments to the Family Dog episode, and they took the first one and made it a short, and I think it played before Land Before Time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that was a strange combination. That never made sense to me, but I was happy that it was seen.
No, I was just happy
theater.
To see a funny cartoon in a movie theater.
Yeah,
such a novelty.
Yes.
It was great.
Yeah.
So,
thanks.
So, what did you contribute to The Simpsons? What do you think you added to the formula there?
Well, they initially wanted me to write one of the scripts and to go over the animation. They liked the fact that as extremely stylized as Family Dog was, that it was the language of live action more, and that the timing of the shots and the cuts were more like a live action film. Mm-hmm. Even though it was very stylized, the way the shots were arranged and stuff like that, they appreciated it and they wanted it on the show. And the quickest way, you know, executive consultant, which was my title, it sounds just absolutely meaningless. the shortest way to describe it is I directed the directors.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get a script and they would be quickly storyboarded. And at the time, all of the people in TV animation were trained on the Hanna-Barbera / Filmation style, which is done for speed above everything. Every shot is done at eye level. You always, anytime you change a location, you start with a wide shot. If people are moving, you go to a medium shot. If they're talking, you go to a close-up, and whoever's talking gets the close-up. And that's the formula, and if you watch any of those shows, that's the way everything is done. There are no high angles, low angles. There's no rhythm to the cutting. It's all very utilitarian. Mm-hmm. Very seldom do you hear somebody's voice off-screen. They're always mm-hmm. shown when they're talking. And that's not the language of film. Film goes all over the place.
Right.
So I had to break the storyboarders' habits, because they were being hired from the TV animation industry, and that's the way they were mm-hmm. told. These scripts that were being written had references to that ranged from Man Ray to Leonardo da Vinci to Shemp from, you know,
you
the
said
Three
the magic
Stooges.
Word for him.
Yeah.
Shemp.
Yeah. I'm just saying, they ranged everywhere.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so I felt like the show needed to be visually, you know, embrace that range of thought. And I said to the storyboard artist, I said, you have to move quickly, but you get to make a film that will be seen all over the world right now, you know? And I said, you know, if the person in the script is doing a Kubrick parody. What does that mean? And I sat down with them and I said, you know, because they would just board it like Filmation. And mm-hmm. I would say, no, Kubrick shoots things symmetrically. He uses wide angle lenses. So let's draw the perspective so that it looks like a wide angle lens. Mm-hmm. And you know, the shots tend to go straight in if they dolly in, or straight parallel. They don't. There are not a lot of angular movement shots. Mm-hmm. And I said, you got to pick, grab The Shining, grab, you know, Paths of Glory, grab a couple of films, look at them, and now board it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, and so they suddenly got very excited because they saw themselves not as people pounding out uninspired visuals, but people who were getting to make films that will be seen everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they had to be done quickly, but they suddenly got on fire. So it was that kind of a thing. It was establishing the visual style of the jokes. So say something simple, like it would say, Homer thinks X, and you go into Homer's thought. The first time that gag came, which became a regular gag, they were on a medium shot of Homer, and then they zoomed into his head. And I said, that's too big of a move. Be tight on his face, and then just tilt up to his forehead for the thought, and then come back down to his face. So it's a very simple move, but it's graphic. You know what I mean? So it was establishing all those styles. And once you'd establish the style, they would stick with it forever. So another thing they did was they were trying to show that there was silence in the room. And I think it was Reverend Lovejoy. And Reverend Lovejoy says something and there's no response. But they put in a blank soundtrack. And I said, no, you can't do that because a blank soundtrack sounds like the sound went off. What you need to have is one person cough. You know? And so they started doing that, and every time they cut to a group to amplify that there was no response, they would have one person cough. But if you did it in one episode, now it became the way to do it. Mm-hmm. So I got to focus on the areas of the show that were unique, mm-hmm. and set the pattern for that, and then that would be followed. You know, there's a certain way you film them at the breakfast table. There's a certain way that they do mm-hmm. watch TV. Mm-hmm. When they did the McBain parodies, you know, it's supposed to be like a Stallone or Schwarzenegger action star. So I remember there was one gag where they had a milk truck, a giant tanker full of milk, but it exploded like it was full of gasoline. And they wrote it in the script. It's like a Joel Silver thing. And the writers just say that to say it. They don't actually know what that means visually. So I sat down with the animators and I said, what that means is when it blows up, we need to see 16 different camera angles of it exploding. And the animation studio, and this was later, so it was Film Roman, they went apeshit because they said, you can't do 16 different layouts inside of 3 seconds. That's incredibly expensive. Each one of those camera angles has to be drawn, and yet you're only going to have them for like 10 frames each. You can't. And I was like, that's the joke, you know, we're going to do it. And so they laid out, and the production managers were just screaming, but they laid out a bunch of different angles. So it was like a Joel Silver kind of thing where it explodes for 10 seconds from 20 different angles, right. You know.
You know what you did there, Brad?
What?
You kept them from being lazy bastards.
Hey! That's right. You're a lazy bastard unless you do 16 camera angles. Yeah, that's right. Milt lives. Yeah.
I want to know, how many people, do we have a percentage, how many people who worked on Rugrats and Mission Impossible?
You know what? It says that I worked on Rugrats. I think I did one drawing to help somebody out. And then they tried to amplify that. And I did a drawing. I never would have asked for credit. I never expected credit. And it's been blown up into I worked on Rugrats.
You created Rugrats.
I did
you
not.
You are the person who
I
made
did
Rugrats.
A drawing.
You did all of the drawings for Rugrats.
One drawing for a friend.
You did 1,000 years of Rugrats. Got
no,
it.
No. I did Simpsons. I did not do Rugrats. Let's straighten that out right now.
Well, you have a plane waiting for you.
I do.
And it's with great reluctance that we terminate this conversation. But can we wheedle not a commitment? That's too serious.
That's way
can we
too
persuade
serious.
You to come back sometime?
You bet. Yeah.
Because there's so much
there
more
should
to
be
talk
a part
about.
Two.
There's so much more to
we
talk about.
We haven't talked about live action.
Oh, my
not
God.
Not at all.
It's because you have too many credits.
Boy, do we have stuff to talk about.
Okay,
good. And, of course, we want to talk about the fact that you learned on the highest tech instrument known to the medium of animation, the pencil.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and how vital that is and how ignored that is now.
Yeah.
It's time to go back. I want to – the next thing I'm doing – if I have any say so in the matter, I can't pay for it myself, but is a live action film, a musical that has about 20 minutes of animation, largely that will be hand drawn.
Wow.
And I also have a couple of ideas for feature animation that I also want to do hand drawn just because I miss it so much.
Oh, yeah.
I don't prefer it. There are definite advantages to CG. It's an amazing tool. Obviously, I've enjoyed using that tool, but I also miss. There's a certain itch that only hand drawn scratches, and I'm itchy right now to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're
you heard
itchy
it here first.
Yes.
Brad Bird's itchy.
Yeah, that's itchy. He worked on Rugrats, and he's itchy.
That's right. That's all. If you come away with nothing else.
Yes. That's remarkably Twitter-like of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So. People can follow you.
Don't. Twitter, I'm probably going to go Twitterverse. Back into my cave.
Okay.
I stopped tweeting for a while, and then I started again right before Incredibles 2 came out. And I think I'm going to go hide for a while.
Well, that sounds like a healthy choice.
After the Oscars. After the Oscars.
Okay. What would Edna Mode have to say about that?
I don't know. She's out here. Hold on. Just a second.
Oh. Edna? Yeah.
What is it, darling? Why do you bring me to these things?
There's no reason, really. There's no reason. She doesn't want to comment. She's already left.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that was a cameo appearance by Edna Mode of Incredibles fame. And this is Brad Bird of Incredibles fame and so much else. Thank you so much for carving a little time out
Absolutely.
Of your day.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Great
this
to see
fun.
You. And so he may or may not be on Twitter when you log in.
Yeah, right.
It might be there.
If you're lucky, I'll be gone.
Yeah. And how about us, honey?
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff. I'm going to say goodbye as Porky. You're going to say goodbye as Droopy. All right? So, abdi, that's all, folks.
Good night, everybody.
Wow.
Maltin on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.